Session number 610, Philip Hicks, 3 reels.
Mr. Hicks, reel 1.
Philip, it's very kind of you to come and talk about the Vietnam Requiem, which we're very glad to have in the museum. The genesis of the series was in your reactions to Time Life photographs and Parry Match photographs, I think.
Yes, that's right. Well, it came about through seeing those photographs, certainly to start with. I don't think that I would have reacted perhaps in quite such a full way if my own father hadn't died very recently prior to that. He had been a regular soldier, professional soldier, fought in both World Wars, and that it was really those two things happening together. Plus, of course, the whole fact that one had been living through this build-up of the... I think the war in Vietnam was becoming a sort of world cause, you know, and the publicity and everything was getting hotter and hotter. So it was those two things, really, that set me off. Yeah. The first photographs, in fact, were Parry Match, not Time Life.
That
was the initial visual shock for me. It was Parry Match.
Yes.
One set, in a spread in Parry Match.
And did those original photographs provide source material of from the very beginning?
Yes, absolutely, from the very beginning. Visually, all my source material, in fact, was from Life magazine, because I simply, when I decided that there was a subject here that I wanted to get into, although I knew to an extent psychologically some of the area I wanted to work in terms of feeling, for instance, I knew right from the beginning that I wasn't making a political stand, either anti-communist or anti-American. That wasn't what I was about. It was a humanist stand, understand?
Yes.
And so to speak, Vietnam was happening, but it was rather like that. So that's why, And I went to Life magazine in Bond Street, and I went through their back files, and I just bought every copy of the magazine that had coverage of the war since the start, which was a lot of copies.
I can imagine.
And I studied those texts and made a lot of drawings from the photographs over a period of 3 or 4 months, I think. And then the larger work evolved out of that work.
Yes. And you, how did you work? You worked from the drawings, then you did some bigger drawings and collage, did you? Or did you then do the prints before some of the paintings, or did the prints come afterwards? How was the sequence?
The sequence is a little bit undefined. I think there was the only logic to the sequence was that I started by making drawings. I made an absolute mass of drawings, and I didn't know then that I was going to go particularly into sculpture or into construction. I didn't really know what I was going to do. The first of the large pieces was the, do you remember the tall green?
Yes.
Medal piece. That was the first one. And I think that was the one where I solved an awful lot of the initial problems of how it was going to come out. I don't even remember that one well, but it's in sort of three sections. There's a top piece, a flat sort of piece, which is redolent of Eastern architecture or something like that, sort of, if you like. Then there's a long rectangular shape like that, which holds a sort of like the medal ribbon.
Yes, quite.
There. And then underneath there's a triangular bit coming out like that with a medal in the middle of it, like that, the round part of that.
Yes.
Well, now that piece started off, in fact, I think it's the first time I've ever told anybody this, but in fact, that piece was designed to be a simple medal. With the rectangle at the top and the circle. That's how I made it to start with. And I found that didn't satisfy me. And so eventually the top piece got designed and put on, and then that overweighted it. So I knew I had to have more on the bottom, so I thought of that triangular shape at the bottom, and it evolved like that.
How very interesting.
And in the doing of all that, and in the painting of the images, it was the first time that I'd worked in that way in my life ever. I'd worked as a figurative painter, painting what you might call straight figurative work. I'd worked as an abstract painter, but I'd never worked with the two things together.
Yes.
And putting them together was, I find, very exciting, just in that sense, purely working in that way. Yeah. And I'd worked in relief before, but only as an abstract artist. So the idea of working with relief and mixing up figurative images, both in terms of sculptural images and flat painted images, that was all new to me, you know. And each piece presented a whole set of new problems that I never had before.
It's one of the most interesting things about the series, this combination of elements.
Yes, I think so. I mean, one wasn't alone, obviously, in terms of sort of Western painting, in handling figurative images and abstract images together. I mean, the pop artists have been doing that, and I was very well aware of what had been going on in that field. People like Rosenquist and so forth interested me. But I don't think anybody had done it with quite the same, well, let's say the same purpose behind the work as I was attempting. I hadn't seen anybody.
No, I don't think anyone else had. And the other artists working on the Vietnam Requiem didn't on Vietnam as a theme.
As a theme.
Had no effect on you. You didn't know, in fact.
No, well, as a matter of fact, the people well, I only came. I can't remember when I saw the big Kienholz tableau, the name of which I can't remember, but it's the one where there's a group of American servicemen. The whole thing is sprayed aluminium, sprayed silver. It's a very big piece. I mean, it must have been 18 foot wide, I should think. And there's a cafe table in the middle of it.
Was that the ICA?
It was at the ICA, that's right. And there's three or four American soldiers, and he did it by taking the uniforms, I imagine spraying them with the rest. Anyhow, he's made them stiff in some way, made them stand up. And then the helmets, and there are no faces, and there are no hands. I don't think they're in hands. So it's just the sort of empty shells and the flag. And then there's a jukebox also spread silver and various other sort of appurtenances at the cafe. Now, I remember seeing that very distinctly, but I have a feeling I saw it after I had completed the Requiem or when I was late in it. Now then, curiously enough, when it was first shown at the Camden Art Centre for the Camden Festival of that year, there were three shows put on together at that time. There was myself, David Medalla, and an American whose name escapes me, unfortunately, at the moment, although I met him and got to know him. It's gone. Anyhow, he'd had a show in a church in Judson, in New York, which was the show that was brought over here. And that was, it wasn't anti-Vietnam specifically, although he would never have done it if Vietnam hadn't been on. He had been in the Marines himself, an ex-Marine. It was really anti-United States imperialism, and he did things like, well, one of the major pieces in it was an enormous puppet about 8 to 10 foot high, surrounded by barbed wire. And if we can put this on your tape, the puppet had a very large penis which was made out of the American flag rolled up, for instance. Do you understand?
Yes, I mean, quite.
It was this sort of work, which again was very different from mine, made its points in different ways. I thought the best piece there for me was a very small, modest piece. So it was very, very poetic. It was a black box about 12 inches, 15 inches by about 8 inches in black perspex, very beautifully made. And so it was very mysterious, you couldn't really see inside. And nestling inside, in fact, was a hand grenade, which you could just make out. And there was something about that that reached me.
Yes.
The contrast. I thought that was a very good piece. It was not so blatant as some of the rest. And then there was a there was a girl who was a student at the college who also made some images on Vietnam. And I remember being quite moved by them. But I can't remember her name, and I haven't seen them since, and I haven't seen or heard of her since. So there were those three things that I saw, and that's all. Now, that's not to say there weren't more, but I do know that there wasn't that much going on. There wasn't as much going on in the States as you might have thought. For instance, when there was a question of my series going over to America, I was warned by a lot of Americans not to take it over. And they said, if you do take it over, you can only take it to New York. They said, even Washington, you better not take it to. Because if you do, it and you are quite likely to get, you know, done over.
Yes.
and they advised me not to do it. Well, now, if that's what they advised me, I can quite understand that probably a lot of artists in America, even though they wanted to do it, and even though they had done it, maybe they couldn't get a public showing. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, quite,
because
yes.
Because public reaction is so strong.
Yes. There were quite a lot of posters, of course, produced in the States, but that's rather a different thing in a
way. It is different, you see. I mean, people will accept graphics, they'll accept things on posters, and we all know this in terms of modern painting anyway. People will accept images in poster form, textiles, etc. But you put that same image on a wall, and they get very worried. I still don't know why this is, and I think it's a great pity, but there we are, that's life.
Yes. the other artist interested, sympathetic to problems of Vietnam, organised sales and that sort of thing in this country, and you contributed, I expect, to
it was the medical. What was it? The Committee for Medical Aid for Vietnam, I think
that was the name.
Keith Grant used to be a very operative in that, and he actually saw the Requiem at Camden, and he wrote me in from then on. And yes, I was one of many artists who sent in work for those sales. And as I was saying to you earlier, I also got involved with an organisation called the Terre des Hommes, which is an international organisation for helping children who are in trouble, either through war or through natural disasters. And they were very active in Vietnam. And Lady Sainsbury was their organiser in London. She got on to me, in fact, just to help with one particular case with a child who wanted to go to art school. But I got interested in it from there on. I may say, it was one of the things that she showed me photographs that they'd got of children maimed by napalm before their hospital. Some of these children had had 50 and 60 operations when they'd been brought to this country, and they had photographic records of all that. And I mean, you have no idea what they were like. I mean, anything you saw in the press or anything I've seen in the press are just peanuts compared to this stuff, you know, which obviously, I suppose, couldn't be published. People would have just been ill. But that I saw that after I'd done the whole series. I've often wondered, if I had seen material of that sort before I did the series, I don't know whether I could have done that series as I did it. Mm. I don't know what I'd have done. That was a real shock, I must say. Because, you see, one of the things that I decided as I was studying all the visual material was that I was not going to deal with the horror.
Yes.
I decided this on several counts. I felt it would have been absolutely dishonest of me to do so, having not actually been involved physically in that way. I felt that if you want to deal with that side of things, really you must have been in it. I also decided that it was, in a way, too easy. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's not too difficult to find a horrific photograph and then, if you like, copy it.
Yes.
Right, and you have immediate shock impact, bang, and there it is. And I felt that this wasn't, you know, this is too, could have got much too fast out. So I decided, took a definite decision to keep that out, all of that out. Now, whether I could have taken that decision if I'd seen these photographs originally, I don't know. I think I'd have turned the whole thing over to Francis Bacon.
Yes. And Terre des Hommes, you gave financial support to by getting admission fees for your exhibition in Edinburgh.
Yes, when we showed in Edinburgh, I don't know if this table ever played in Edinburgh, but I decided with Ricky DeMarco's agreement that we would put an entrance fee on the show to try and raise some money. And have you ever been to the Edinburgh Festival?
Yes, once.
Because, you know, everything is one off up there, so to speak, and everything's being put on for just once. And so, and it's absolute chaos. I had no idea what it would be like. I've never had such a frantic 2 weeks. I stayed up for quite a lot of the festival and found, in fact, that you had to do everything that normally you'd expect a gallery or somebody to be doing, you had to do yourself, because everyone was so frantically busy. And so, I mean, for instance, I used to have to take over at lunchtime and things on the gate very often, because there weren't enough staff to cover the exhibition. You know what I mean? So I was personally sitting there, watching people come up the door, suddenly notice that it was 20p to come in, and then think and wonder, and perhaps go away again, or perhaps come in, you know, which I find emotionally quite quite disturbing.